You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic.
I'm Cameron Lalata.
And I'm Matt Garasimovich.
And today we're covering part two, chapter 38 of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate. Kind of coming to a climax with Krimov's thinking on the Bolshevik Party and the Soviet Union as a whole, and a fairly emotional chapter as he goes to meet his ex-wife, Yevgenia's brother-in-law, Spiridonov, in Stalingrad, and drinks with many of the workers who are still in the factory on the left bank, on the right bank in Stalingrad itself. And this kind of leads him to a pretty, I'm going to use this word a little bit ironically, a pretty revolutionary thought on the Bolshevik Party as it stands today. And it's on how it has changed, or perhaps not really changed, since 1917, or since the days of Lenin. Is there anywhere here that you'd like to start?
Yeah, we only have so much time on these dailies, so I think we can focus in probably on the end of this chapter, I would say, which is this kind of quiet, solemn, introspective Krimov, as he is kind of just, you know, laying there, probably a little drunk, thinking about life, and he's really kind of perturbed, I would say, by the one specific question on why did everybody confess to crimes. Why did they confess to these really ridiculous and heinous accusations that nobody who knew them would actually believe that they did? And it's something that I don't know he adequately answers in the chapter. It's kind of something to think about, and there's some possible solutions on this, but this question kind of sets up a lot of what we have to come to the rest of the book, I think. And it sets up a lot of these issues surrounding personal responsibility and our relationship to the broader state at large. And I do think that it starts to pose some interesting and challenging questions, and I'm thinking specifically on the chapter that we're going to read tomorrow and the day after that, where it sort of seems like the easy answer is just to say that, well, I live in an authoritarian state, therefore, I just everything's handed down to me, I just do what they say. But this interesting thing that's making him question everything is, right, why do we continue to participate in this if we know it's wrong, and we know, you know, essentially everybody knows that this person wasn't a foreign spy, so why do we even accept that resolution? It's just something that he can't quite get out of his mind, and it's challenging for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And this is a pretty broad-ranging question, right? Because he starts, as he's kind of sitting in the darkness, he thinks of back to the days of when Lenin died. And he thinks of all those old Bolsheviks who accompanied his body, and one nameless individual in a Caucasian-style dress, which was looked down upon by the others, who was not really a member of the party, not really, was a member of the party, but not really a member of their group, who will, of course, who is, of course, Stalin, and will be the who will be bequeathed the state to be, and the rest of them, for the most part, will later be, you know, tried and executed as saboteurs, as wreckers, or whatever. And that kind of leads to the broader point of it's not just them. Now there's all these other arrests, kangaroo courts, fast convictions, and why is it that I had said nothing? Why is it that he insists that he had never written a denunciation, because, you know, it sort of has this awful tinge to it. But of course, if you read what he's actually saying, of course he actually did in practice do so, right? That is how it's not only did he not speak, he thinks of Bukharin specifically, and not only did he not speak in the defense of Bukharin, who he did not believe was a spy, he kind of signed a letter against him. I think it was a letter. Yes, I I raised my hand to vote. I signed, I gave a speech and wrote an article, and I still believe my zeal was genuine. But where were my doubts then? Where was all my confusion? What is it I'm trying to say, that I'm a man with two consciences, or that I am two men, each with his own conscience? But that's how it's always been for all kinds of people, not just for me. And that's a really interesting line to me, because I can't say this is what is informing Grossman writing this chapter, but I think it is worth noting that Grossman himself was forced into writing a sort of denunciation himself. Now, this is in 1952 or 1953, when the doctors, before Stalin's death, immediately before, when the doctors' plot is in full swing, when there's this whole kind of anti-Semitic campaign alleging that a group of Jewish doctors are trying to kill Stalin. Many Jewish, surviving, frankly, Jewish intellectuals and higher-ups in society are made to publicly, are forced into, or at least pressured into, denouncing these doctors or signing letters against them. And it's worthwhile that on one occasion, I forget the exact date, but Grossman is invited to a writer's meeting, which he goes to. Unbeknownst to him, it is actually an attempt by the an attempt to get him, among some others, to sign a letter denouncing the doctors. And Grossman does sign the letter condemning them, even though he, by all accounts, seems to know, or at least believe correctly, that this is not true. This is not a real plot. And so when I'm reading this, I'm also reading this within the context of not just, Kremlin, but this power that it holds over everyone in society. Not quite everyone, actually. Maybe that's an overstatement, right? And so it's like, how can I exist, and how can I believe that these people are innocent and yet still participate? As you're kind of talking about, what is my individual responsibility to participate in the system? And right, exactly as you say, well, you know, of course, it's the state; it's the victory of officialdom over that. But of course, it's not quite true, because you have Grekov, who Krimov cannot stop thinking about. When he's drinking early in the night, he wishes Grekov was there. I think that's in truth, as we were talked about previously, because Grekov is infinitely closer to his character and what he really is than any of the other surviving party officials at this point. As we kind of talked about before, Grekov and the men he led have the same revolutionary spirit and the same spirit of inquisitiveness that in 1917 would have been celebrated. But now they are stepsons of their time, because that is no longer what is needed now. And so I think that's part of why what is makes Grekov continue to be compelling to Krimov. And he is. So we have people like that. And then he continues thinking about it and thinks, well, you know, when someone is denounced, when someone's sent to a camp, people stop. And it's not just them. There's a fear surrounding everyone associated with them. It is their children. It is their brothers. It is their sisters. It is their parents, everyone. But it's not true that everyone stops talking to them, because there are plenty of little old women who continue to mail parcels to them. And he thinks, you know, how brave is it for, you know, I think of that, you know, how brave is it of them to do that? But they don't even seem to be afraid when the idea seems to strike such fear in him. He doesn't even consider it a possibility. And yet there are people who still do that. Many people, in fact.
Yeah. You don't know what fearless looks like until you see the old Russian ladies.
Yeah, right. So he's really wondering about this fear. He thinks about, you know, people are able to overcome fear. He says, children pluck up their courage and enter a dark room. Soldiers go into battle. A young man can leap into an abyss with only a parachute to save him. But what about this other fear? What about this fear that millions of people find insufferable? This fear written up in crimson love letters over the leaden sky of Moscow. This terrible fear of the state. And then he decides, no, it's not fear alone that can achieve all this. It's sort of a revolutionary cause. It's the attachment of morality, not with morality itself, but with morality to a certain cause, which then makes everything in pursuit of that cause justifiable. And even though he kind of has two minds on this, right, he says that he is faithful to the ideas of the revolution. And yes, it is right that we do that. At the same time, clearly his thought process is indicating that maybe that's not correct. Maybe it's not right that that the revolution is able to do all this, because upon one time that was done to us. Once upon a time, when he was young in 1917, if you took up the cause of the revolution, you could expect forced labor, you could expect imprisonment, you could expect death. And now if you are the truest adherent of it, you instead get chauffeurs, nice dinners, all these other perks that were once the domain of the very, you know, leaders of the state that they were trying to overthrow.
Yeah, and there's a kind of tension between what he is talking about and this idea of morality And I think it's tough to really, I don't want to get too much into a debate on morality, but, you know, not the place for this kind of episode at the moment. But what he's pointing to is how different systems will kind of talk about how they have that exclusive right to morality. And if you are outside the system, you are immoral. And that is how he is able to, when he's working as the commissar in House 6-1, how he's able to, you know, as he said, or in general, he says, where enemies were concerned, Klimov had never felt the trace of pity. And this is how he kind of conceived of Grekov, because Grekov was an enemy. So why do you need to have pity for your enemies? They're in the wrong, you are in the right, you are fighting for the thing that is moral. And so this is a question that I really am not completely convinced that he answers in the novel, and I don't know 100% that we have a convincing answer for this even today on how you combat this, basically. I do think it's a task in and of itself to point it out, of course, because it's hard to see through that sort of veil when you're in it. But it's something that is uniquely challenging, I think, to the 20th century and continues to be really prevalent today. And I still don't think that we have a great answer for it. And you might feel like maybe you have an answer for it, but I don't think we have an answer that works widely still. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Because, otherwise it'd be fixed. Or yeah. You could say we'd be moving in the right direction, which I don't think we are.
Yeah, right.
Then again, I'm cynical, so.
I mean, hey, it's kind of the nature of the topic we cover. I think it doesn't lend itself usually to that much optimism.
Yeah, I think we're probably doomed, unless you are a corporation looking for us to consult on your business, in which case there is hope for you. The low, low price of please email us to find out.
It doesn't matter who you are. We can pitch you. We work, and you're on your way at the door, but I got slots open. not too much to say here. I also want to note this, the intense loneliness that Klimov, I think, doesn't even realize he feels until the moment he beats Spiridonov. And it's like, filled with this, suddenly realizes how alone he is, which I think is characteristic of this system. There's this sort of truism that maybe you were told this. I was certainly told this before I went to Russia, and it's not true. That, that there's a sort of like, okay, well, all Russian people, maybe all Slavic people in general, everyone who lives in this area, they're very cold to everyone unless you're your friend, and then they're very warm to you. In my experience, plenty of people who didn't know me were very kind to me and were like, hey, let's be Instagram friends as soon as they met me. Maybe that's because I was, not Russian, and they knew that, and that made it a different calculation. Just not my experience. Could be your own experience, could be different. But I think this is characteristic of the time that you never, unless you have an intensely personal relationship, you tend to be alone, such that you may not even realize until you're among those people again. And related to that, I wanted to go to a comment from Dominique today, who said, really loving how easily enemies become friends and friends become enemies, relating to the larger point of the changing nature of the old Bolsheviks, or the changing stance of them, I should say. Klimov remembering how the people who brought the revolution were treated like criminals until they were the ones running the show. Yeah, good comment. I mean, especially you see that in the way that Grossman or the narrator very intentionally, rightly or wrongly, in the actual place of history, in this retelling of it, places Stalin definitively outside that original circle.
Yeah, I think that. Well, and what is interesting about that too is how quickly it happens. I mean, we're talking about like 20 years. Right, that's pretty quick for such a drastic rewriting of how things have happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially to have that rewriting with so many people who were there to see it. Primo.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but there's so much to talk to here about here. I feel like we could go on for a while. Maybe that's better saved for the full episode.
I think so.
I think so too.
In that case, you will be hearing from us again soon.